Let us start with just a few minutes of silence. You have, I believe, understood something of the meaning of silence from what we considered yesterday afternoon. In that sense, silence for just a few moments. What do you find becomes highly intensified in deliberately when deliberately sitting, attempting to be silent? True enough, the noise of the mind, as you say. But what are some of the outstanding features of that noise of the mind?
It's all to do with me, ego-centered.
We are self-absorbed, aren't we? Now, we have had a few meals, two main meals and one minor meal, if we may call breakfast a minor meal, in silence. There was the silence of speech. But were we completely self-absorbed or not? Not completely. Well, of course, I mean, a thing like self-absorption or its opposite ordinarily doesn't take place 100%, true enough. But on the whole, there is the tendency towards just self-absorption. One's absorbed in oneself. Or one is conscious of those around us. In what sort of way? That's the question.
I find one is far more aware of the other person's personality than when you talk.
Yes, that is true. One becomes aware of the other person's personality. That is the constant outward expression of what that person is. But there is something which is very important for each one of us from the point of view of realizing true silence. As we become aware, there is a reaction from us, one way or the other. The two broad aspects are attachment or aversion. Something which I like about that person, something which I dislike about that person. Attachment and aversion come in. It is never an impersonal awareness. So you see, there is a love-hate disturbance going on all the time. If that doesn't happen, one gets self-absorbed in one's own personal affairs and problems. the inward looking work becomes self-critical because one is driven fundamentally with the desire to progress oneself, having laid down what progress means. Supposing I were an acorn, and quite happily I fell from the tree. And began to grow. Now inside me, the acorn, is the blueprint, so to say, of the tree to come. But it is never absolutely rigid. It cannot be, because other factors, climatic and what happens on the soil and all the rest of it, are playing their part. The life process works freely and happily, undisturbed by preconception. There's no preconceiving anywhere on this. It's only man who can preconceive. The winds and the temperature and all the rest of it cannot preconceive. So, there'll be a growing process which is the harmony of all the natural forces at play. But here, in this situation, where I desire and have the urge to grow in terms of my preconception of progress, a strange factor has come in. A factor which intrudes upon the wisdom of life. Now, the wisdom of life for us human beings includes elements which of necessity are not included where the wisdom of life for plants or animals or insects or something like that is concerned. Necessarily so. Because that which is emerging and has to come and is coming to fruition has its own specific nature. And insofar as it fulfills its own specific nature, it is true to life. Now we are not like that. I, the acorn, have no power to argue with the wisdom of life and say, no, I want it this way, I think this will be much better, you're wrong. But I, the man, the human being, am rather different. I have the power to look within and manufacture my own inner world, which essentially has the elements of desire, inexperience, and above all, abysmal ignorance characterizing it. And I can impose this inner workings of my mind upon the wisdom of life. And this imposition, this opposition to the wisdom of life, manifests itself fundamentally in terms of attachment aversion. This is the play of greed and violence. And you see how ignorance at root is the source of this greed and violence. So, my self-absorptiveness, when I'm externally silent, is something which is spoiled by the play of these forces. The mind just goes on chattering away quietly or loudly inside oneself. And the more intense the wish to be silent, to keep this chattering mind suppressed and stopped from chattering, the louder is the chatter inside. Because that mind's got a will of its own. That mind's got a mind of its own. So you see, we are a battleground inside ourselves. Now, how does one deal with this? Because remember, the true silence includes all sound. It is not devoid of sound or noise. What does silence then mean for your mind or my mind? How do we deal with this situation? You remember, I think I suggested it yesterday, didn't I? Follow what uprises in the mind, the noise of the mind. Follow that noise and see whither it goes. And seeing whither it goes, don't prevent it, don't resist it, thereby produce a state of conflict, nor indulge it, which will also only breed further conflict. Because every indulgence feeds the desire for more. You see, this play of greed and violence, of attachment and aversion, is an extraordinarily subtle play. It is also of enormous dimensions. Its scope and its extent is simply terrific. So much so that in a sense it is true to say that all the time we are defeated at every turn. But you will find that one of the true ways of release out of that state of defeatedness is to put aside our conceptions of progress and growth. When our predetermination ceases, when it is no longer a case of my will, then the will of the wisdom of life becomes freer to operate through us. What that wisdom of life is, we don't know. If we knew, there'd be no problem. But we don't know it. We haven't got anything like that true omniscience. To start with, just consider the meaning which we humans attach to omniscience, to know everything. No, it's not that. Certainly in the psychological and the religious context. It's not being a super encyclopedia which is omniscience. That is a mere know-all state. And it is not a know-all state. It is the state of clean unknowing. This clean unknowing is something quite extraordinary. It is the state of right receptivity. Not that weak state, that flabby state of the mind, where anything, anybody can impose upon you, tyrannize over you. And the first power to tyrannize over me, if I am in that state, will be the devil in me. So you see, I have to put aside my ideas of progress, of development. There is another aspect to this, and a very important one. My ideas of progress and development stem from self-conception, which is always a self-misconception, and the inveterate tendency to orient everything in relation to me. The whole of the unconscious self in me does that. And as long as I orient anything and everything to me as an isolated self, the wisdom of life gets truly blocked. If that happens, obviously there cannot be a true silence. And if there cannot be a true silence, there cannot be a true seeing. There cannot be enlightenment. If you like to use any other term, salvation, liberation, there cannot be that. So, watch this self-absorbed state and see what happens to one's attention. It is dragged away by this, that, or the other. And the elements of attachment and aversion play a powerfully powerful part in spoiling our flowering process. In becoming aware of what within us rises up and spoils it, and also in not fighting against it, nor indulging it, it dissolves. That is to say, that particular psychical energy which took that shape, which is to our detriment, will be resolved into its original state of psychical energy and become clean and take a right shape afterwards. The rightness and wrongness cannot be determined by us, because again our preconceptions, our intellectual preconceptions, will interfere with the process. It's a living process, and you know that the life process is an unknown process. We don't know what's happening. We think we do. And especially in our age, where science has risen to such preeminence, and by means of science we have discovered the how anything happens to an extraordinary extent. So in this scientific age, and with all the influences, the psychological influences playing upon us as a consequence of the mind of the world influenced by the scientific age, we think in terms of knowing how to do this, that and the other, and predetermining. Now let all that subside. The scientific activity of the mind is indispensable. Science itself is indispensable. The most indispensable external tool in our modern life, psychologically and spiritually also. It's necessary, because science is the one factor that most effectively frees us from misconceptions, from speculative fancies regarding what is actually happening and how it is happening. That's why science is extremely important, of the first importance. But apart from that, we must also learn to be free of the conditioning influence affected through science. Moment we put science on the pedestal, instead of having science as the tool, then we go wrong. So now, once we can see this in some way or other, get a chink of light through, and allow the wisdom of life to work, it will bring about a state of inward harmony. And in that inward harmony, silence in its real nature will operate through our whole psychophysical being. It is a healing influence. It is a whole-making influence. You want the proof of it? Every day, when you are in the state of dreamless slumber, the really deep dreamless slumber, you are in the state of silence. Although there are sounds going on around you, although your body will naturally react, anybody observing you through all your sleeping hours will see that this is the case, but you will be in the true silence. And wherein does the most important part of that true silence come in? All the functioning of desire, of the psychical forces of attachment and aversion have also gone to sleep with the body completely. Now there is no intrusion by desire, by attachment and aversion and their conflict on the mind. And the mind has come back to its innocent state. Now this is the state in which the beneficence of life, of transcendence, works unhindered through you, and you are restored by that aspect of your slumber. It's the most powerful restorative. You are restored to the state of health, wholeness, holiness. And this beneficence is the root source from which we derive our real meaning of the word benefit. Now, note this very carefully. Benefit. Bene facio. I make well. Well made. Perfectly made. The Sanskrit sukrit, happily created, excellently made. And who does it? Not you or I, but in this state of silence, of deep slumber, this mystery, this unknown, marvelous thing, its beneficence works through you, and you are benefited. And you don't know how it works, you don't know what benefit means. Now consider the meaning of seeking benefits. We take to religion because we are driven to it, in the early stages anyway, for the benefit of our souls. Consider this carefully. What do we know about what is the benefit of our souls? In our waking state, our mind is conditioned in the ordinary restricted and restrictive material way. The root idea and feeling associated with the word benefit is the gaining of something which I like, which I desire. This has nothing to do with the activity of the beneficence of life, of transcendence. Nothing to do with it at all. It may come incidentally in the course of our living. And in fact, it does come inevitably. Because when there is this freedom from the poisoned barbs of desire, attachment, aversion, then there is the state of true happiness. There is poise. There is inward peace. There is health. Health of body and mind. This is the healthy state in reality, even though you may be feeling a headache or whatever it is, as a temporal passing phenomenon. You know, when the light of truth emerges freely, illuminating the whole psychophysical being, we see extraordinary things which we never saw before. We see how what we commonly would call an illness, in certain instances of course, or a pain, is part and parcel of the state of holiness, of health, wholeness. If the understanding and the approach have pure love functioning through them, and pure love lets the wisdom of life act without hindering it, if that pure love is there, then your eye is single and your body is whole. And that state of the single eye and the whole body is a state of silence, utterly free of self-absorption. And this word self includes within it not merely the body, which of course is inevitably there. Not only our ordinary qualities, as we call them, our mental activities, our feeling processes and so forth, but every single passing thing, ephemeral thing, all that constitutes the self and selfness, insofar as we are related to it in terms of that being oriented to us. The self-orientation, when that self-orientation is completely out, the self has dissolved forever. The selfness has, as the Buddha used to say, talk of its extirpation, like the stump of a palm tree, never again to sprout. No evil thing will come out. It's the state of him who has gone thus, the Tathagata, thus gone, the Sugata, the happily gone. So you see, all these things which we try to impose by predetermination, I want to be happy, I want to be well, I want to be secure, do not predetermine. Let the wisdom of life do the needful. Now, if one sees this intellectually and accepts it intellectually, beware of this. When the difficulties come, which in the normal way I would fight against, because of my intellectual acceptance of the idea, I will say, oh no, I must not fight against it, because I will get just what I want. This is our human absurdity. We are a funny lot, funny peculiar. All right, I've said quite enough now.